metal filled the windows. The shuttle was closing on the rear of the forward section, toward the ring of warp nacelles. If the massive transport ship followed usual design logic, then the main engineering deck would be close by. "Anyone see a hatch?" said Wheaton. "There." Saru spotted a hexagonal port in the hull and pointed it out. With a few bursts from the shuttle's maneuvering thrusters, Wheaton positioned the Yang over the hatch and settled them down in place. "Activating magnetic clamps." In the crew bay, Subin and Yashe had already retracted the deck plates as the shuttle made a hard seal, revealing the hatch below them. Subin drew her phaser and adjusted the setting.
"I can burn us through."
"Wait!"
Saru bounded back into the rear cabin and dropped into a crouch. "Pilliar technology has a high degree of automation. I think I may be able to access the airlock control remotely." He pulled the tricorder from his belt and quickly programmed a tight beam transmission that would mimic the mechanism's control signals.
"Tick-tock," noted Johar.
Saru sent the transmission, and the hatch popped open with such rapidity that everyone in the shuttle flinched. Searing hot air wafted into the shuttle, bringing with it the acrid stench of burnt polymers and the braying hoots of what could only be an alarm siren.
"Go,"
said the chief engineer, and one by one they vaulted through the open hatchway and into a scene of chaos. Saru landed in a catfall on a curved service gantry. The platform extended away in both directions around the equator of a thrumming column of hardware built in an hourglass shape. The alien design was markedly different from the system aboard the Shenzhou. Two massive injector arrays pulsed with bright light as matter and antimatter were channeled into a central chamber at the nexus, but rather than the steady, rhythmic heartbeat they should have been exhibiting, the pulses were coming at conflicting intervals, colliding out of sequence. The entire framework of the warp core was vibrating against its support structure, sending sparks flying in great orange-red gushes from the connector points. Plasma vents on the upper levels spat gaseous plumes of vapor as the system spiraled toward a critical overload. Beside him, Johar cursed softly in Arabic as he cast an eye over the situation.
"This is very bad."
He took a breath, then raised his voice to be heard over the alert sirens.
"Someone find me a command console, right now!"
The team scrambled to obey, and Saru found himself a step behind Zoxum as the nurse came across a member of the Pilliar crew. A female of the species in a metallic crimson ship suit with a simple headdress around her scalp, the Pilliar woman was slumped next to an auto-valve control that appeared to be part of the ship's deuterium conduits. Saru scanned it with his tricorder as Zoxum got to work.
"Just unconscious," said the nurse as he applied an injector to her neck. "I think she fell and struck her head."
Saru glanced down at the Pilliar. She was hairless, with skin the color of dry earth, and a high-ridged forehead bisected by a long nasal rib. Like all Pilliars, she had dual sets of nostrils, and they twitched in unison as she started to come around. Saru checked his universal translator and held his breath.
"What happened?"
Her eyes fluttered open and tried to focus.
"You are all right. Please don't make any sudden moves,"
began Zoxum, in as soothing a tone as he could manage over the howl of the sirens. His request was ignored as the Pilliar woman reacted in shock to the sight of the intruders aboard her ship. She jerked backward, snatching a beam cutter from the tool belt around her waist and brandishing it like a dagger.
"Who are you? Keep back!"
"I am Lieutenant Saru of the Federation starship Shenzhou, and this is Nurse Zoxum." Saru raised his hands and tried to look non-threatening. "We've come to help you."
"Nathal said there was another ship on sensors."
She blinked, distrust written across her face.
"Did you do this to us?"
We are here to help, reiterated Saru. When we could not reach you via subspace radio, we boarded your ship. He gestured upward to where the Yang had force-docked. We mean you no harm.
Get away from her!
The shout came from close at hand, and Saru spun to see more of the Pilyar crew emerging from the smoke. Another female, this one in a similar uniform and headdress, but pale green in color, led from the front. She drew a spindly pistol from a belt holster and aimed it in Saru's direction.
Touch her, and you'll regret it!
Commander Nathal.
The other Pilyar spoke as she struggled to get to her feet, and Saru ignored the threat, helping her regain her footing.
I am all right.
You are intruders on my vessel, said Nathal,
disregarding her subordinate's words.
I have every right to shoot you where you stand.
Your ship is malfunctioning, and that's your first thought?
Johar appeared behind Zoxum, holding his engineering kit tightly in one hand.
Shoot first, accept help later.
What did you say to me?
Nathal's face darkened.
I'm saying don't ignore the chance to save your vessel.
Saru had never seen Johar this angry about anything.
We don't have time for niceties, so put that damned gun away and help us stop that core from breaching, or else we all die.
The chief engineer's words were stark and cutting, and Saru found himself nodding. Please, he began. I'm sure none of us wish to perish today.
We can solve our own problems, Nathal
shot back, glaring at the other Pilyar woman.
Hekan, you fell silent. I need your report.
With respect, said Hekan as she detached herself from Saru. This is not a time to choose obstinacy over survival. We could use more hands.
Saru counted only a half dozen Pilyars on the platform. Where are the rest of your engineering staff?
This is everyone, Nathal
growled, finally jamming her weapon back into its holster.
The rest are injured.
I can help with that, said Zoxum. Take me to your injured.
Nathal's quadripartite nostrils flared, but then she relented, barking an order to another of her crew.
Dekaz, take the alien to the infirmary.
Then she glared at Saru and the chief engineer.
Very well. You may assist us here, but if you try anything—
Sure, whatever.
Johar was already turning his back on her, jabbing a finger at a sandy-faced Pilyar in a blue outfit.
You, where are the injectors?
The alien crewman pointed and led the engineer away.
Do all Federation officers speak that way to their superiors? Muttered Hekan.
Some more than others, Saru admitted.
Is there a monitoring station I can access? This way.
Hekan led him to a U-shaped console with an interface of sliding control rods.
I was attempting to avert a photon surge when the deck shifted.
She touched her head where Zoxum had applied a dressing.
You have to forgive my commander. She's quite protective of her crew.
Saru scanned the system. Understandable. A worrying number of warning flags blinked across the screen of his tricorder. If you only have a small complement on board, perhaps we should consider evacuating all of you to our shuttle.
No!
Hekan cut him off before he could finish.
We are not abandoning this ship. There's too much at stake.
Her stubby fingers pushed and pulled at the sliders, but to no avail.
Curse this! The decay rate in the core isn't slowing.
Lieutenant Commander!
Saru heard Yashe shout through the haze, her voice coming from somewhere back toward the hatchway.
I think we can save this barge, but it's not going to be easy. We need to bleed off the energy buildup and take the warp core offline, but the safety interlocks won't disengage. It's caught in a loop.
Saru peered at his tricorder and saw the problem. The sensors governing the interlocks are malfunctioning. He looked down the length of the shuddering core stack, picking out a broken section of the framework. The The system that would normally have allowed the crew to attempt this risky override was unable to release. The computer, doubtless still operating with false readings from damaged sensors, telling it everything was working well.
"I can't switch off the interlocks from here," said Hekan, her face creasing in annoyance. "They keep rejecting the commands."
"You must have a secondary reset control." Saru cast around, looking for a manual switch.
"We do."
Hekan pointed upward to a narrow, enclosed catwalk that ran the length of the chamber and down toward the central spinal frame of the starship.
"It's inside the maintenance crawlway, a set of two levers behind a blue panel."
"Ah." Saru belatedly realized that he had just volunteered himself to climb up there and throw the switches. He couldn't stop himself from looking down, through the mesh plate of the decking beneath his feet, right into the black abyss of the engine spaces beneath.
"You'll need a gravity belt to get up there," Hekan was saying.
"I won't," Saru told her, slinging his tricorder over his arm and rolling his shoulders.
"This is a poor survival choice," said a voice in the back of his head.
It sounded worryingly like one of the elders from his youth, admonishing him for venturing out after curfew.
"It could kill you."
"Yes," Saru said to himself. "If in doubt, assume everything will kill you." The Kelpian crouched and coiled the muscles in his long whipcord legs. And then, from a dead start, he leaped upward to grab the bottom of the catwalk, dangling 3 meters over their heads. The next few moments passed in a fear-charged blur for Saru. Acting on instinct, he hauled himself up onto the walkway and scuttled down the length of it toward the enclosed section. He didn't allow himself to think about the empty space below his hooves, how one random shudder from the Pelear ship's space frame could fling him off and send him down to be dashed apart on the machinery below. He only thought about one step after another and a set of levers behind a blue panel. The scorching thermal release coming off the damaged warp core rose past him in shimmering waves, and the spiracles in his bare skin itched as they bled off the heat. Saru ducked low and squeezed himself into the catwalk proper, bumping his head on the curved ceiling.
"Do you see it?"
Hekan shouted up at him.
"Not yet," he called back.
An unpleasant electrostatic hum resonated through the frame of the metal, oscillating at a frequency that, to Kelpian senses, was like having a needle driven through one's skull. That, and the heat, and the churning terror he was barely keeping under control, made it hard for Saru to concentrate. He screwed up his courage and pushed on, the access conduit widening into a small chamber ringed with varicolored panels. Saru swept around and found the blue one, wrenching it off with a quick twist. Behind it, there were the two levers, and he allowed himself the briefest flash of relief. He gripped them both and was about to pull when he heard a noise below him. The Kelpian looked down. Crouching there, beneath the mesh of the deck plate under his boots, sandwiched between the lower section of the catwalk and another crawlway, was a humanoid that was most certainly not a native of Pelear Zell. Heavy-set and stocky, the being was likely from a high-gravity world. It wore ragged, unkempt clothing, and the alien had 6 limbs, a pair of thick legs, and 2 sets of muscular arms. Their eyes met. He glimpsed the mirror of his own fear in the other being's gaunt features, the certain knowledge of imminent death only heartbeats away. The alien looked up at him imploringly, and Saru saw that one of the being's arms was trapped beneath a baffle plate that had dropped into place when the overload began. The other being's circumstances would be meaningless if Saru did not complete his task here. He braced himself against the deck and pulled hard on the reset levers. The warp core gave off a sound like an animal in agony, and Saladin Johar winced in sympathy with the machine. Some of the junior ratings aboard the Shenzhou joked about him when they thought he didn't hear it, suggesting the chief engineer was actually part Betazoid, but that Johar's empathic sense worked only on mechanical objects and not organic life forms. Perhaps there was some truth to it, he reflected. A good engineer could almost feel the stresses on their hardware like it was an extension of their own body. This might not have been his vessel, but still he could sense the strain as it resonated across the span of the Pelear ship's hull.
"Saru!" he shouted. "Did he do it?"
"Reset is active," called Subin from a nearby control podium. "Emergency core shutdown cycle in progress."
"Everyone brace for the outage."
Johar grabbed at a safety rail as the throbbing glow inside the warp core slowed to a gradual stop and then went dark. He felt his body briefly grow lighter as the big ship's gravity generators went through a power dip before that passed, and the core lit up once again.
"Cycle complete," Nathal said grudgingly, her hard gaze boring into a holographic display. "Hopefully the restart won't kill us all."
The Pelear engineer in the blue jumpsuit ran his hands over a gestural interface, and Johar used his tricorder to remotely manipulate the firing sequence of the injector modules. He could see where the problem had originated. A misalignment had set up a destructive cascade effect inside the system that had built and built until it was self-sustaining. Part of his analytical mindset was dismantling that revelation in the back of his thoughts, trying to understand why such a thing had occurred. But for now, it was more important to get the warp core up into standby mode. Without the power it supplied, other vital systems like life support would fail and kick off a whole raft of other problems to deal with. The pulsing glow began a sluggish ascent from the lower section of the core, a twin band of light descending from the upper array to meet it in the middle. A wave of relief broke over Johar as the pulses moved in unison and collided in sync. The telltale vibration from the alignment error was absent.
"Well, there we are," he said,
putting aside a burst of joy at the thought of not perishing.
"A little teamwork, and a grisly death for all is averted."
"You can go on your way now," said Nathal,
turning her gaze on him.
"The problem has been dealt with."
"You're welcome," Subin replied with a snort. Johar shot the Maserite a warning look, then glanced at Nathal.
"Seriously? You don't actually believe that we fixed this, do you?"
He shook his head.
"Commander, what just happened was an act of survival, not a solution."
"The human is correct."
The Pelear engineer offered the comment, but quickly wilted under Nathal's stare and went back to his console.
"I want you off my ship," said the alien captain.
"You have made that abundantly clear," Johar replied. "But I do my job right, Commander. And I tell you now, if I leave this vessel with my people and you run this warp core back up to operating power, it'd be like I pulled a phaser and shot you myself."
He pointed up toward the injector array.
"We need to track down and eliminate the cause of that Nadion pulse, because if we don't, it'll happen again."
Johar met Nathal's look.
"And next time you come crashing to a halt, help might not be so close at hand."
"Or worse."
Hekan, the other Pelear woman, who seemed to be the ship's second-in-command, approached from across the platform.
"What if it were the Tholians who came to investigate?"
Invoking the specter of the quarrelsome crystalline beings gave everyone pause. Both the crews knew what kind of threat they represented, and certainly for the Pelears, who lived close to the Assembly's borders, the danger was all too real. Johar released a sigh and raised his hand.
"Starfleet respects the sovereignty of the Pelear Zell and your authority on this ship, Commander Nathal."
"You have an unusual way of showing it," said the captain, ice forming on the words.
"But I cannot in good conscience leave this vessel until your crew is safe," Johar went on.
I'm sure you have no desire to risk their lives.
Nathal glanced at Hekan and then to her engineer. Both of them made a gesture with the flat of their hand that Johar guessed was their equivalent of a nod. At length, she spoke again.
When this is over, I will have some words with your commanding officer.
I am sure she will be very happy to listen, he replied, catching the sight of Petty Officer Yashe as the other engineer came through the fading haze.
All systems are in low power mode and read stable, she reported. The lieutenant did us proud.
Johar's eyes narrowed.
Where is Saru?
He looked around. The Kelpian was nowhere to be seen.
He went into the central maintenance channel, said Hekan. He didn't come back out?
Her face fell.
I didn't think...
Nathal's expression turned stormy, and she barked out an order to her crew.
Find him!
Curiosity kills.
There was a story that Saru had heard many times as a youth, a cautionary tale designed to instruct. It was a sorry narrative about a young Kelpian who disregarded the rules of his society. This fictitious youth, whose name changed depending on whoever was most deserving of admonition that day, grew curious about the prohibited places, to the point that he foolishly ventured into dark and unknown territory. It did not end well for him. For no matter what wonders he saw, the youth would ultimately suffer some terrible fate, and all because he became too inquisitive for his own good.
Curiosity kills, the elders would say, nodding sagely.
Now, as Saru carefully picked his way along the length of the curving enclosed walkway, he wondered why he had never learned the lesson the story had been trying to impart. The act of pulling the manual reset levers had also caused the mechanism in the baffle plate to retract, freeing the trapped being beneath the decking. Before Saru could call out to him, the six-limbed alien scrambled away and vanished into the shadowed depths of the long catwalk, the clatter of his feet fading as Saru descended toward the aft spaces of the vessel. Saru should have turned back, returned to the gantry and the rest of the damage control party. But curiosity, that old fascination, pulled on him. Holding out his tricorder, Saru took one step, then another, following the non-Piliar into the bowels of the massive transport ship. In the dimness, it was difficult for him to estimate the distance he had traveled, but it felt like a long way. More than once he halted and deliberated about turning around. Each time, curiosity drew him on, but with every step it was at war with his fear. The catwalk extended into the first of many cavernous cargo modules, huge pods that were large enough to encompass an entire city block. Saru wasn't certain what he expected to see in there, stacks of freight, storage tanks, and the like, perhaps. But it wasn't this. Ranged out beneath him, the interior of the module was a chaotic mess of cables strung from every available support, and between them were thick sheets of flexible metal or heavy sailcloth like one might expect to find on a wind-powered watercraft. Tents and enclosures hung from every corner, and bioluminescent lights cast soft, weak color into the darkness. The heavy warmth and earthy scent of living beings in close proximity wafted up to him, and as his eyes adjusted to the low light level, Saru became aware of figures moving around the suspended structures. There were a lot of them. Dozens. No, hundreds or more. The tricorder in his hand chimed, and he studied the device's display. He saw the same confused patterns of myriad life signs that Burnham had glimpsed on the Shenzhou's sensors when they first arrived. What he had thought to be a scanner glitch was nothing of the kind. The cargo module was filled with people.
Curiosity kills. The words echoed in his thoughts once more, but Saru shook his head to banish them and reached out to grab hold of one of the cables. The alien construct beneath him seemed threatening and gloomy, but Saru had come too far now to draw back from what he had discovered.
Who are these beings, and what are they doing here?
He could not return without knowing the answer. Slowly and carefully, he descended into the shadows. 3. The suspended cables and flexible floors formed a makeshift encampment in the middle of the cargo module. Stitched together out of mismatched materials, discarded storage crates, polymer shrouds, and more, there was a kind of threadbare ingenuity to the haphazard structure of it. As Saru worked his way down the cable to see what was the roof of the settlement, he picked out sections that appeared to be dormitories, and others packed with barrels of some fast-growing fungal matter. Moving along the upper surface, he passed over inverted conical ducts that acted as dew catchers, collecting ambient moisture from the air harvested from the ship's life support system and the exhalations of the people inside the module. The shadowed, dim space had its own microclimate, as warm as blood and with a spicy tang to the air that made the Kelpian's nostril pits twitch. There was something else he could sense, too. An ambient ebb and flow, like distant waves breaking upon a far-off shoreline. The feel of it came through the striations in his skull, as Saru's innate electrosensitivity picked up the impression from all around him. In a peculiar way that he couldn't articulate, it reminded him of home. Setting his tricorder to continuous scan mode, Saru pressed on, spreading his weight so he could move without drawing attention to himself. He saw no sign of the being that had met his gaze back on the maintenance catwalk, but there were many others of the same species, some exhibiting differing genders, some clearly at the younger or older ranges of age. By their activities, these did not appear to be members of the transport ship's crew. Saru guessed they were passengers of a sort, but if that were so, the crude and basic living conditions they were in did not speak well of Pelear generosity. He looked up again, considering the size of the module. Shenzhou's scans had shown 8 containers of this dimension mounted on the spinal frame of the big ship. Were there other gatherings of these beings in each one, similarly clustering side by side in the belly of an alien vessel? Saru pulled his communicator from his belt, but the dull chirp it emitted when he flicked up the antenna grid told him it would be impossible to signal Johar, Wheaton, or the Shenzhou. The local particle density was still extremely high, smothering all the frequencies he could access. He paused, considering his next move. His desire to know more conflicted with his instinct for self-preservation. It would be possible for him to retreat, perhaps, climb the support cables and eventually retrace his path back to the engine chamber, but that would leave too many unanswered questions, and Saru could imagine Captain Georgiou's steady gaze on him, pressing him for an explanation he didn't have. He pictured Chithalo and Burnham and the rest of the crew. "They would expect me to retreat," he told himself. "They would expect me to flee." Saru rejected that option. He was a Starfleet officer. This was a first contact situation. He was obliged to reveal himself and attempt a meaningful interaction with these beings. And besides, he had already met one of them. He continued on, looking for a clearing, for a place where he could show himself without engendering a negative reaction from the humanoids. Ahead, the wash of the invisible electrostatic field grew more intense, and Saru was drawn to it, picking up the sounds of multiple overlapping voices. He came across a space like a courtyard, a set of interlinked metal decks beneath a web of cables where dozens of the aliens were gathering. Their language was quick, full of sibilants and harsh glottal noises that went back and forth in rapid chugs. Saru's universal translator was having difficulty interpreting the speech, continually stopping and restarting its program as it failed to find a key into the alien tongue. It was rare to find a linguistic framework that the UT's expert system couldn't quickly configure into Federation standard, but so far the device could only render the most basic of concepts from the conversation happening below. Anxiety. Waiting. Conflict. The translator gave no more detail than that. The key component was fear, and Saru gave a rueful nod. That was something he could appreciate. He took a deep breath and gathered himself. There was an open spot at the back of the courtyard. He would lower himself down, raise his hands in a gesture of friendship, and a change passed over the crowd in the blink of an eye, every single one of the aliens falling silent. Saru spotted movement on the far side of the open area. A trio of the four armed beings in close order moved through the group, and he noticed they each wore a dusty band of red cloth around their four wrists. By the way the others stepped back to let them pass, it was clear they had a kind of authority among the aliens. Looking more carefully, Saru noted that others in the crowd wore bands of their own in different colors, some with two or three on their wrists, but none with four. Then the red bands stepped apart, and Saru realized that they had been shielding a fourth figure from sight. Not an adult, he guessed, a younger female of the species. She wore white robes that were grubby with age and use, and her stance was off-kilter. As she walked forward, Saru saw why. One of her legs was severely deformed, and each step she took was an effort. But as she passed by the others in the crowd, they reached out to touch her, and in turn, she ran her hands over them. Where the white robe moved, the humanoids seemed to grow calmer and more assured. A spiritual leader? The thought crossed Saru's mind. Although she seemed too young to be considered any kind of elder, the effect the robed female had on her fellow beings was immediate and undeniable. She was just a short distance away when the hobbled young female stopped suddenly and looked straight up, directly at Saru. He blinked in shock, tensing for a shout of alarm, but instead her gaze was full of interest, of curiosity. Not so that of her escorts, however. Two of the red bands followed the female's gaze and saw the Kelpian hiding in the shadows overhead, and they showed the reaction he had expected. Angry shouts boiled up from the courtyard, and the assembled crowd below closed ranks to shield the white-robed figure from whatever threat Saru represented, others squaring off in a manner that clearly promised violence.
No! No!
Saru raised his hands and tilted back his head in an attempt to look harmless. Empty hands proved he carried no weapons, and showing his throat was a signifier among many species of a passive intent, but it did little to calm the mood. Anger, panic, distress. The UT tonelessly reported the temper of the aliens to Saru, but without specifics, it was of little use. With care, he climbed down into the courtyard, and the aliens drew back to give him space. The tallest of them only came to the level of Saru's sternum, and he could feel the ripple of raw terror his appearance generated in the assembly. It was a strange experience for the Kelpian to be the feared rather than the fearful. There was no means of escape for him. The humanoids surrounded him on all sides, and some of them had produced heavy cudgels or stubby blades. Saru knew without doubt that if he made one wrong move, they would interpret it as an attack and react accordingly. If it came to that, could he fight his way out? There was a Type 2 phaser on his belt set for stun, and he knew how to use it, but the last thing Saru wanted to do was to start shooting at a race of beings who were perfectly within their rights to consider him an invader. The situation was slipping out of control, and he knew he had to navigate a way through it. They are afraid, You know how that feels. Use that. Saru took a breath and silenced his own anxieties. He felt the ephemeral pressure on his senses once more, the phantom crackle of electromagnetic energy in the air. The subtle play of sensory fields was a part of how Saru's kind communicated intimately with one another, and with each passing second, he became more certain that these beings shared a similar trait, but on a different level. Moderating his breathing, drawing his own electrostatic pattern into quiescence, Saru opened his arms once again and showed the humanoids that he was defenseless. "I come in peace," he intoned. "I ask you to forgive my intrusion. I mean no disrespect." Anger ebbed, turning to suspicion and doubt. It wasn't much of an improvement, but it was a step in the right direction. The weapons he had seen were lowered, but still the humanoids kept their distance. Then, from the far edge of the group came the female in the white robe, pressing awkwardly through the ranks of her red-banded companions despite their obvious displeasure. She cocked her head to study Saru, her wide, dark eyes taking him in. He mimicked the motion, then tapped a finger on his chest. "I am Saru." It was the most basic, most elementary communication in the universe. "Saru," he repeated, sounding it out. The Kelpian hoped that his name didn't translate to some terrible insult in their language.
"Saru."
The female in white echoed his words. Her voice had a soft musical quality to it. "Yes." He pointed at her. "You. Who are you?" She was reaching up to touch her chest in the same place Saru had touched his, when the crowd around them erupted in a new wave of fear. Before he could react, the three males with the red bands had shot forward and enveloped the female in white, dragging her away. She vanished into the depths of the crowd with a gasp, and in a blink, it was as if she had never been there. Saru thought that the humanoids were reacting to something he had done, some cultural taboo he had inadvertently transgressed. But then he realized they were drawing back from an area to the rear of the courtyard, forming into a ragged defensive line. He turned on his hooves to see four Pelyars in steel-gray ship suits advancing into the light from the biolumes. Each of them carried a particle beam carbine, and they threw wary, uneasy glares at the crowd surrounding them. One of them, a stern-faced male with tattoo markings across his cheek, pointed at Saru.
"At last! There's the off-worlder!"
Another of them, wearing a sensor monocle, made an exasperated noise.
"What in the name of the suns are you doing down here? They could have killed you!"
"Who are these beings?" Saru demanded, drawing himself up to his full height. "Why are they on board this ship?"
"Come with us now," said the tattooed male. "You can't be here. They don't like outsiders."
"Who?" demanded Saru once more. "They aren't from Pelyar Zell."
"They're Gorlans,"
said one of the other Pelyars, as if that answered all possible questions.
"Come on! We don't want to provoke them any more than you already have."
Saru turned back, searching the faces of the crowd for any sign of the female in the white robes, but he saw no trace of her. "I was communicating with them."
"No, you weren't," said the Pelyar with the monocle. "Their language is impossible to translate."
"Like talking to the rocks,"
said another with a derisive snort. The crewman with the tattoos put a firm hand on Saru's shoulder and pulled him away.
"Come with us," he insisted. "Don't worry. They won't follow."
Reluctantly, the Kelpian allowed himself to be led off.
"They're here because they want to be," said the other Pelyar. "Everything is fine as long as nobody does anything stupid."
He glared at Saru.
"Such as disturbing one of their gatherings."
They walked through a connecting tunnel and out of the cargo module into a corridor that went back toward the bow of the ship. A hatch rolled shut behind them, sealing off the passage. The Pelear with the tattoos eyed Saru coldly.
"Is this all you Starfleet officers do? Go where you aren't wanted?"
He didn't wait for Saru to reply.
"It's a wonder your Federation still exists."
"I will freely admit this is not the sort of complication I was expecting to encounter out here," said Captain Georgiou as she rested against the side of the desk in her ready room. "Now it appears we have stumbled across not one group of beings in need of assistance, but two?"
"That is unclear," said
Lieutenant Commander Johar. Burnham's gaze shifted to the holographic images sharing the room with them, the grainy virtual versions of the Chief Engineer and Lieutenant Saru being transmitted from the cockpit area of the Shuttle Yang. The images were laced with static and of low definition, but she could clearly read their expressions. The engineer had that tight-lipped look he got whenever something wasn't working exactly as it was supposed to, and for his part, Saru's face was the very definition of hangdog.
"The Pelias have told us that the Golans are on board the ship of their own volition, and we've yet to see anything that..."
Johar's words suddenly became a jumble of grating hisses, and the image disintegrated into random pixels. At Burnham's side, Commander Chithalo scowled and tapped an intercom panel.
"Boost the gain on the signal."
There was a pause, and then Johar's image returned.
"Shenzhou, do you hear us? You dropped out for a second."
With the wake of Nadion particles still interfering with subspace communications, it had been Ensign Fan who came up with the idea of using a low-powered line-of-sight laser as a means of keeping in touch with the rescue party. The only problem was the beam worked point-to-point, meaning it had to be constantly aimed at a receptor panel on the shuttlecraft's hull to work.
"Please repeat your last," said Georgiou.
"I said we've yet to see anything that contradicts the Pelias' assertions."
"Lieutenant Saru doesn't agree," said Chithalo,
studying the science officer's expression.
"I am still forming a hypothesis," ventured the Kelpian, returning to a phrase Burnham had heard him utter more than once during their analysis of the damaged monitor buoy.
"Burnham!"
Abruptly, the Andorian first officer turned his piercing gaze on her.
"The Pelears and the Gorlans. What do we know about them?"
"As we're aware, the cargo craft is a Pelear vessel," she began, drawing up recall from her years of studies on Vulcan. "They are a small but highly technological civilization, rated at Type 2 on the Kardashev scale. If you prefer, I can provide the Richter classification."
"Generalities will do for now," said Georgiou.
"I would characterize the Pelears as thinkers rather than doers," she went on, shifting to a more colloquial vernacular. "They are carbon-based bipedal humanoids comparable to standard norms from a Class M planet. They use robotic drones to perform most of their manual labor or hazardous tasks."
"There was that autonomous ship we saw on arrival," noted Chithalo.
Burnham nodded.
"Pelear culture is broadly divided into two discrete but cooperative factions, the Alphans and the Betans, who live on the respective moons of their home world. They have recently approached the Federation Council to discuss the possibility of membership."
"And the Gorlans?"
Georgiou picked up a datapad from her desk and studied the ethnological charts of the humanoids displayed there.
"I have to admit, I'm not at all familiar with that species.
It would be true to say they are the polar opposite of the Pelears, Captain."
Burnham gestured at the pad. "They originate from a high-gravity environment, so they exhibit greater muscle mass and bone density. They have a reputation for being..." She searched for the right adjectives. "Rough-hewn, hard-scrabble types. In the past, they are what some would have called frontiersmen."
"I've heard of them," offered Johar. "Well, second-hand. My CO on the Stonewall once told me about encountering one of their ships. They have a wanderlust, Captain.
They range far and wide from their home system, looking for planets where they can set up subsistence colonies.
Correct, agreed Burnham. Gorlan culture is based around tenets of self-reliance and a strong theological belief system. But they are an introspective race, largely private. We really know comparatively little about them.
Lieutenant Saru, in your report you mentioned issues with the Universal Translator, said Georgiou. More detail, please.
Saru sighed. The Gorlan speech patterns are very malleable and nuanced in ways that are hard for the UT software to parse. Extracting anything other than the simplest concepts was not possible.
It could be that the UT needs a larger sample to work from, said Chithelo. With time and exposure to their language, we might be able to program a better solution.
With respect, sir, Burnham broke in, there may be nonverbal elements of communication that our systems can't pick up on. The prospect of learning more about a little-known race of sentience was compelling, and she wished once again that the captain had sent her instead of the Kelpian. The Andorian's cranial antennae arched slightly.
Do tell, he said firmly.
Lieutenant Burnham is right, said Saru. I sensed an extant electromagnetic field effect while I was in close proximity to the Gorlans. I believe it was directly linked to their group emotional state.
Georgiou raised an eyebrow. Can you read that?
At present, only in a crude fashion. As the commander suggested, I would need time to observe and interact with the Gorlans over a longer period to gain a greater understanding.
And the Pelears don't want to let us do that, Chithelo folded his arms across his chest. Commander, what's the status of the transport ship at this time?
There's no immediate danger to the vessel or the Shenzhou, said the engineer. I've got Ensign Wheaton working with Yashe and the rest of the team on the final elements of the warp core repairs. Sir, I have to tell you, tensions are running pretty high over here.
He paused and gave an uncomfortable frown.
It's not just Saru's walkabout that they didn't like. I have to take the blame for some of it. I didn't exactly get off on the right foot with Commander Nathal. I wasn't as delicate with my opinions as I should have been.
That is putting it mildly, sir, noted Saru. The captain gave a low chuckle. Saladin, if this situation was about playing nice with people, I would have sent a diplomat and left you in engineering. Then the levity was gone, and Georgiou focused on Saru. Mr. Saru, when you were down on the hold with the Gorlans, tell me what you felt. I want your emotional take on this. Saru looked away. Burnham sensed the Kelpian was struggling to find the right words. There was a very real fear among them, Captain. But I cannot be certain if I was the source of that, or if there is more going on here we are unaware of. He went on, talking about the gathering he had witnessed and the apparent presence of some kind of venerated figure among the Gorlans. I believe there was an avenue of communication to be opened there, but because of the Pelear intervention, we may have missed our opportunity.
I want more than that, said Georgiou.
Johar looked away at something out of the hologram's visual field.
You may get it, Captain. Commander Nathal and her XO are here.
Burnham saw the unmistakable stiffening of Saru's body as the Pelears arrived.
This way, if you please.
Ensign Wheaton gestured up through the hexagonal hatch toward the interior of the docked shuttle, and Nathal's expression soured. At her side, the Pelear officer called Hekan waited patiently for her commander to climb up into the Starfleet craft, and Saru watched them closely as they surveyed the interior of the Yang. Hekan's obvious interest in the technology was tempered only by the formality of her role as Nathal's second, and he imagined that if she had been alone, the Pelear woman would have been looking at everything. Nathal, however, glanced around with a haughty and dismissive glare, finding the holographic images of the officers in the Shenzhou's ready room.
Which of you is in command?
She demanded, wasting no time with preamble.
Georgiou leaned forward slightly. I'm Captain Philippa Georgiou of the starship Shenzhou, and...
Do you make a habit of illegally boarding other people's vessels, Captain?
Nathal didn't wait for her to reply.
You acted without authority or permission.
I regret that was necessary.
The captain inclined her head, letting the comment roll off her.
I'm pleased to hear that your ship and your crew are now safe.
She didn't need to add that that state of affairs only existed because of the Shenzhou's intervention. Nathal's hands clasped each other and held rigid.
I have a recovery operation to attend to, Georgiou. This conversation is cutting into my time, so can we be quick about it?
Of course.
Saru heard the captain's tone harden.
I really only have one point that requires clarification. I would like to understand why there is a large population of Gorlans on board your ship. As our sensors return to full capacity, we're detecting quite a lot of them.
How is that relevant?
Nathal looked to Hekan for support, but the other Pelyar offered nothing.
Starfleet's mission includes safeguarding the welfare of all life forms we encounter, added Commander Chitelo. We're simply inquiring after their well-being.
The Gorlans are not in any distress, Hekan said quickly. They're not prisoners.
She seemed affronted by the possibility.
They are refugees, Nathal corrected with a frown.
From where? Saru couldn't stop himself from asking the question. The coordinates of their homeworld are clear across the quadrant.
From a colony planet, of course.
The Pelyar commander shot him a sideways look.
They were settlers, or some such. Their outpost was attacked by a Tholian patrol. They obviously didn't realize how territorial the assembly is.
The displaced Gorlans were forced to flee into space, said Hekan. But their vessels barely made it to the nearest habitable worlds.
Our worlds,
Nathal broke in, her tone clipped and accusatory.
They limped into orbit around Pelyar Zell, begging us to help them. And now we are doing so, taking them to a safe place.
Our government has found the Gorlans a new planet to colonize, added the other woman.
I see.
Captain Georgiou seemed to consider this.
And where is this planet?
A few light years distant, said Hekan. Most of them are already there. We are the last of the transports.
Saru became aware of Nathal watching him intently.
I can see why your officer might have come to some erroneous conclusions about the Gorlans. Their ritualistic ways are strange to outsiders. It would be easy to observe them and make the wrong assumptions, but as my second stated, we are not depriving them of anything.
Then why are they afraid?
Saru bristled at the Pelyar commander's dismissive tone, blurting out the questions.
Why are their living conditions so basic? Don't mistake their lack of sophistication for anything other than what it is,
Nathal replied.
The way the Gorlans choose to live is up to them.
And yet you think less of them for that.
Saru spoke without thinking, and the moment the words had left his mouth, he knew he had been wrong to voice them, even if it was what he believed.
That'll be quite enough, Lieutenant, said Chitelo,
silencing him with a look. Nathal went on without any indication that Saru had uttered a sound.
You must understand that the satellites of Pelyar Zell could not accommodate such large numbers of displaced aliens. The ecologies of our alpha and beta moons are delicate. They are strictly organized. Our solution is the best for all parties involved.
I'll make that clear in my report, Georgiou said neutrally.
Saru waited for her to challenge the Pelyar commander, but she didn't.
As well as detailing the circumstances around your warp drive malfunction.
We only wish to complete our mission, said Nathal, and then she straightened her ship suit, putting on a formal air. On behalf of my crew and the Pelyar cohort, I would like to thank the crew of the Shenzhou for their altruism.
Her words had the rote diction of something rehearsed, and Saru wondered if Hekan had coached her commander.
but we do not require any further assistance.
Nathal looked around at Johar, Wheaton, and Saru, as if she expected them to leave immediately.
Respectfully, added Hekan, the situation aboard this ship is an internal matter, and Peliar Zell is not yet a member of the United Federation of Planets.
Or bound by its rules.
Nathal had the last word.
Quite so, agreed Georgiou. I apologize if you feel that I,
she looked at Saru and Johar and then away,
or any of my officers overstepped our bounds. I assure you, we had only the best of intentions.
The captain took a breath, and Saru saw a flicker of steel in her eyes.
But I would remind you that if Peliar Zell does wish to join the Federation, showing cooperation with Starfleet would work in your planet's favor.
She glanced back. Burnham took this as her cue to speak.
For full clarity, for our report to Starfleet Command, it would be useful to speak to a representative from the Gorlan colonists, to be sure they do not require any specific assistance of their own.
Belatedly, Saru realized that Georgiou's tactic throughout this conversation had been to lead Nathal to this point, so that any refusal from the Peliar commander would make it clear she had something to hide. If she kicked them off her vessel in the next 10 seconds, that would give the lie to her assertion that all was well. Nathal's cheeks darkened, and at length she gave a tight reply.
They have a designated speaker to communicate with other species. Hekan will arrange the meeting with him. Then you can leave.
She got up and pushed past Saru, climbing out through the shuttle's hatch without another word. Burnham entered the lab and crossed the room in quick steps, approaching the workspace against the far bulkhead where the monitor buoy lay in a line of deconstructed parts. The alert from the ship's computer had brought her down here, an automated message in her work queue informing her that the first stage analysis of the unit was complete. In all the excitement of the rescue operations and the discoveries aboard the Peliar transport ship, she had pushed aside working on the buoy.
"What do you have to tell me?"
she asked the air, taking in the dismantled device. In working condition, the unit would have resembled an oblate silver cylinder ringed by a curved solar array with a sensing head at one end and a cluster of comm antennae at the other. But now it was an orderly set of stripped component parts, the outer surfaces bleached by solar radiation in some places or pitted with micrometeorites in others. The sections had been broken down by a set of automated manipulator arms and arranged for examination according to guidelines put in place by the Starfleet Corps of Engineers, but Burnham ignored that, instead gravitating straight toward the midsection where the buoy's memory banks were situated and, she hoped, the answers as to why it fell silent. Programming a macro probe, she retracted the casing and surveyed the interior of the module. Dozens of duotronic data cores were arranged in rows within it, each one capable of holding gigaquads of stored information. The memory bank should have contained months of recorded sensor scans and subspace telemetry, but the buoy's subsystems had refused to transmit any of it back to the Shenzhou. Burnham would need to physically unplug the cores and reset them one by one in a reader array that could recover the data. She had the first core detached when the lab door hissed open and Commander Chithalo strode in.
"Lieutenant?"
"Sir?" Burnham didn't look up, her eyes on the delicate duotronic core held in the macro probe's grip.
"Forgive me if I don't rise. This needs steady hands."
"Can't you just use a micro-tractor beam?" said the Andorian, coming over.
Burnham held her breath as she slowly moved the core to the reader.
"These components show signs of particle bombardment. I don't want to project any other energy at them unless I have to."
The core dropped into the reader with a soft click.
"One down, 23 more to go."
She exhaled and glanced up.
Can I help you, Commander?
Checking in, he explained. This business with the Pelear ship is the captain's main concern, but we can't neglect our mission.
He aimed a long blue finger.